This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for Talk Louisiana. We start with Adam Knapp, the president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. He's held this post since 2008. Started his career in the private sector in Chicago and Silicon Valley as a consultant for a major company, and he returned to Louisiana, native of Lake Charles, graduate of Davidson College in North Carolina, and he is 12 years now head of the chamber, and we're going to talk with him, of course, about the COVID world, which is ever-changing. But before all this began, Baton Rouge, according to Southern Business and Development magazine, won major market of the year, receiving all kinds of accolades for its business climate. And I know you were thumping your chest about this, Adam Knapp, but how have things changed in the last 5 months? Our city, like many others, is, of course, trying to adjust to this crisis. Did we lose Adam Knapp, or did I leave him speechless? Let's see if we can get him back. And I think that's him calling in right now. I think he thought, my goodness, Jim, starting with a softball. What about Southern Business Magazine, Business and Development, naming Louisiana, Baton Rouge, the capital market, the market of the year prior to all this chaos that's going on, Adam? I know you have to be happy about it, but of course, Baton Rouge, like any other city in this time, is adjusting and having some challenges. What's going on?
Well, I would say this. It's a compliment to the team and our partners in all of our nine parishes for last year's work. This the last time we saw this award for Metro Baton Rouge was back in 2013, and it's hard, one, to have a lot of the economic development work that it takes. Now, this is, of course, recognition for performance in economic development that is now beyond us, and the pandemic has stripped away the last decade of job growth. So one year's of performance is not going to change the situation that we're in the middle of right now, but it is a recognition of a good year of work last year.
Well, right now Congress is deliberating on what to do next. The $600 a month for workers expired on the 31st at midnight, and right now there are different approaches to what comes next. How do you see it?
Well, you know, I think this is important to think about in the context of what it means here for our residents in Baton Rouge. On July 31st, the number of folks claiming unemployment insurance payments in Baton Rouge was probably around 58,000 folks as of our report last Tuesday when we put it out. That's quite a lot of folks who were, you know, taking those dollars, and you saw it in consumer spending. Jim, is that the metro area spending rate was up over pre-pandemic levels in some of our parishes, you know, relatively close to even. So it's going to be interesting to understand how that's going to drop off and what that means for families. We expect something will come through these negotiations. The White House has signaled that they are expecting to have something of a unemployment insurance deal that will come through the House and Senate, and they're trying to shepherd through the process. It's just taking too long for folks that are relying on these dollars each week to get through this period. The biggest debate has been about the disincentive for return to work from employers that feel like the wage levels in a lot of states have been higher than what the jobs are offering, and so that it just encourages folks to stay home rather than return to work if there's a job available. And so I think for right now, I think what we've been trying to emphasize is if you want to get back to work and you're worried about things for your family, there are jobs out there. When we went through a research report of the 1,400 jobs posted at BR Works on our website and what kinds of skills are available to folks, and that's available. It was an advocate story that came out yesterday about it.
And I misspoke a moment ago, and a listener already caught me. It's not $600 a month. It was $600 a week. And combined with the state benefits, that means that workers receiving unemployment in Louisiana over the last few months on an annual basis would have $44,000 tax-free, which means if you were working, you'd probably have to be earning like $55,000 to net 44. So most people in Louisiana don't earn that kind of money. And they do in New York City. They do in Los Angeles. And yet the plan was one size fits all. So that's one of the complaints about this. And our state, in a weird way, benefited from this.
It did, and look, this was a very difficult period, and businesses who wanted to see consumer spending maintained have benefited from it, for those dollars continuing to push through the economy. The big challenge for those that need workers back is how do you compete to get them back right now? And so I think that's at the heart of the debate that Washington is fighting right now, is how do you strike that balance between encouraging folks that have the ability to go back to work, that have access to jobs, to do so rather than just staying on unemployment. And that's what really unemployment insurance program is meant to be, is a middle period between two jobs, not a permanent situation or a longstanding situation. And so the question is, how does that program encourage folks to go back to looking for work if work is available to them?
All right. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. I've been scurrying the last few minutes to find this story that a listener asked me to pose a question to you about. It was in The Advocate, let's see, on which date did it appear in The Advocate? July 19th, about Louisiana having a tax rate that we often hear that is detrimental to our citizens, but according to one report, this is Best Places, an Oregon-based data company that compiles and compares data for real estate, marketing, industrial site selection, and other firms, ranks Louisiana as the eighth most tax-friendly state in the country. Do you agree with that, Adam Knapp?
We have said this for a long time, Jim, that the combined rate of a lot of the programs and incentives and tax structures in Louisiana make it overall a tax-friendly state. The biggest challenge, as you well know, is it's a very complicated tax code from a business perspective. The advertised corporate tax rate, income tax rate of 8%, is a high income tax rate for corporate income tax, and then you have a mercurial system of incentives and exemptions that lower that overall rate to make it more attractive and more friendly. But it is not a streamlined and clear system, and that's been our case for a long time, is to try to find some way to simplify the tax code overall to see on paper the benefit of what our actual tax rate is as the rate, rather than having to go through all these various exemptions. Whether you're an individual or a business, it's both ways. We also are a high sales tax state, whereas other states are low income tax, high property tax states. And so it's where you want to be getting hit. And it's hitting consumers. Usually those consumers, or they call it a less progressive mm-hmm. tax code. You know, if it's hitting folks at the consumption side rather than at the income side. So that's where they're. A long debate about whether that's better to do it the way that we do it versus other ways.
Phil in Lafayette. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Adam Knapp.
Hi, I'm calling from Lafayette. My name's Hugh Robertson. You said that the unemployment payments were tax-free. They are not. You have to pay federal tax and state tax. You do not pay Social Security tax on those payments.
Okay. Well, and that, of course, is a big hit, but I stand corrected. There is some tax burden on the benefits, but still, when we're talking about $44,000 a year, the per capita income in Louisiana, I don't think is $44,000. It's below that. So we've seen this in a lot of restaurants in particular. And the workers have a point. They say, look, I'm making as much or more staying at home, and I don't have to risk my life. Now, Adam Knapp, it's hard to argue with that in some cases.
And I want to come back to, what does this mean in the economy? The unemployment insurance, and I'm not a tax expert, Jim, on what one is paying or not paying on their unemployment insurance. The question we ask is the effect of it in the economy. We have a 9.6% unemployment rate, according to the feds right now, and our consumer spending is back at pre-pandemic levels. And so you would expect that it would be down some amount as in terms of consumer spending, but it hasn't been, largely because of that federal stimulus buoying the consumer spending in our economy. And so we're interested to understand how that's going to affect both families but also businesses that are consumer-facing right now.
All right. Now, Sean Audemars writes that if we had a higher minimum wage, we wouldn't have this problem to the degree we have. Does he have a point?
It's an argument of whether the higher minimum wage is also going to create job losses or fewer jobs to be available in the economy in the long run. That's been the longstanding debate about whether a market forces, which have in Louisiana driven up wage rates, where the very few positions are making the federal minimum wage anyway. Some of the studies that are out there show that the minimum wage in Louisiana, from a market forces perspective, has already driven that up much, much more significantly. And that has created an effect of higher overall wages.
You're saying the 725 actually hurts our economy, that we'd be better off with no minimum wage? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that very few folks are paying it because it takes a higher wage rate to actually attract talent.
877-217-5757 is your number. Adam Knapp, president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber for a dozen years, is back after this 90-second pause. And we also hear from Treasurer John Schroeder. This is Jim Inkster. A few more minutes with Adam Knapp, president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, who's been surveying the landscape with zeal for 12 years, but for the last 5 months. And it was March 16th that Governor John Bel Edwards put the stay-at-home order in place. And things have evolved, but we still have a huge issue in Louisiana with now more than 4,000 lost souls due to COVID-19. And nationally, that number has gone up and away. Louisiana is ninth in the country in the number of deaths to coronavirus. And the national number now, I believe today, has exceeded 160,000 deaths in the United States. It's now just under 160,000. 877-217-5757. In our remaining time with Adam Knapp, Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. If you look, I understand you get 247. That's maximum on a Louisiana benefits, unemployment. But the 600 a week, if you work a 40-hour week, that's $15 an hour. As I see it, the problem is not the $600 a week. The problem would be the low-wage Louisiana. I'm out.
All right. Well, he makes a point, and others have as well, and thank you, Mike, that, Adam, if we had a $15 an hour minimum wage in Louisiana, as some states do, we would not have an issue with people staying at home in lieu of coming to work. They would be earning more or the same if they worked. And people generally, if they have a job, they not only like getting paid for it, they like everything else that goes with it, the association with their coworkers and clients. And a higher minimum wage, according to Mike and others, would be beneficial in any number of ways. How do you see that? Adam Knapp, what's your take on that?
Going back to the BR Works website that we were sharing some information about earlier, you'll be able to see on there a lot of jobs that are paying good wages available through that site that require more experience to get into them. But they also have a lot of entry-level or near-entry-level jobs that are available. I noted that Amazon's announcement of their project, the logistics project that's under construction near Segan Lane, is going to have entry-level wages of $15 an hour. So there are opportunities that are out there that are hiring right now. We created BR Works to try to help folks find out about what is actually hiring. And if for a family that's going through a situation where they're facing the current period of not having the unemployment insurance benefit, there is a urgency to make sure that they're trying to get access to wages, and there are jobs out there. You can find them on BR Works. There are over 1,400 listed available, and I encourage folks to go take a look at what jobs are out there and whether they have skills that currently match what's out there right now.
Well, we thank you as always for joining us, Adam Knapp, and let's talk again soon. And I tell you what, we're waiting for John Schroeder, and Matt says he's not with us just yet, so let's continue for just a moment, and we do have some other questions online that I can get to you if you've
got. I'll flag for you just as you're getting ready for the treasurer. Those, I'm sure he's going to make the point about applications are still available through mid-August for businesses that haven't taken advantage of any other federal program, they can get in line. There was news yesterday that over 9,000 folks had applied. Over 1,000 businesses in the metro Baton Rouge area have applied. So this is something that's important for businesses to know how to take advantage of. So I'm glad y'all are going to have them on to tell more about that.
All right. Well, last week, a listener notes that there was a report that the U.S. economy contracted by about a third in the last quarter. How does Baton Rouge compare with that number based on what you know?
Yeah, in our report that we released last week, and folks can find this at our website at brack.org/recovery, we look at our economic indicators report. We showed the relative decline of our consumer spending, small business revenue, and small businesses that are open, and we compared ourselves to five other southern cities of relatively similar size, Louisville, Little Rock. It showed that we're all seeing the same amount of overall economic decline in consumer spending and small business revenue. And so I think you'll see that we're all getting hit pretty similarly. The big concern we have, as we shared in that presentation, is we erased a decade of jobs. When you looked at, we dropped from close to 420,000 jobs pre-pandemic to at bottom of about 360,000 jobs in the metro area, and have started to rise back up, but we're still way off from where we were. This is worse than we saw during the Great Recession, as folks will remember, back in 08 and 09, and worse than what happened in the 2016 flood. So it's stark what we're going through, and not like anything we've seen in decades.
Now, it was, you said we went from 420,000 people working to what, about 360? Is that correct?
Overall, number of non-farm jobs in the metro Baton Rouge area went down by about a little more than 6%. I'm sorry, a little bit more than 10% from March of this year to the present. We lost about 10% of our jobs from around 420,000 to about where we are today at about 370,000.
And as bad as that number is, it's still not 33%, which is what the national number showed as far as the total retraction in the economy. So a lot of work to do, heavy lifting to go, and Adam, we'll follow it with you. It's a fascinating time. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Jim.
See you soon. 877-217-5757. We're joined now by Treasurer John Michael Schroeder, Jr., who's twice been elected to the office that was previously held by John Neely Kennedy. And good morning to you, Treasurer Schroeder.
Hey, Jim. Good morning.
Nice to talk with you as always. It's been a while, but hopefully we'll have you on more often. And a listener has already noted, this is Tracy at the Capitol. Kennedy was he was on all the time when he was treasurer on every show, and you've taken a more low profile. Is that by design?
Well, don't take this the wrong way. I go where I'm invited.
Well,
I never say no. And we do have a tremendous amount of speaking engagements. So all you got to do is invite me. I don't like inviting myself. My mama taught me a long time ago, don't invite yourself to dinner.
Well, I'm going to, well, since you brought it up, Kennedy used to invite himself back in the day, but you're not John Kennedy. And you were on this program when you were running for office, and you noted that you and John Bel Edwards have long been friends. You were elected the same year, neighboring districts, but you have different philosophies. You've had some disagreements. Is it personal now, or is it just a professional disagreement?
No, I tell people, I'm almost 60 years old. I got John Bel about 8 years or so. I look at my time as a politician as my public service. You know, I'm a Army veteran, as he is. I spent time in law enforcement. You know, I believe very strongly that we all should serve in some capacity. So I don't take this personal. I tell legislators all the time, if you take it personal, you need to go find another hobby or another board to sit on. You can't be personal. So no, I have nothing personal against the governor. We obviously differ on some things, but you know, and I go to work every day and looking to make the state a better place.
Now, when you were running, you said the basic disagreement, if you will, or just a different philosophy, is that the governor is a lawyer and you're a business person. Is there an inherent division or collision when it comes to somebody who's come through one side of the world and another like you who's come through the business side?
Well, what I try to do, what I've taught my children who are 33 and 30, you have to respect everybody. And I, what I try to do is influence based on my beliefs, what my experiences are. But, Jim, I can't make you drink the water. You know, I was brought up a certain way in the business world. I was born and raised in a business family. And, you know, I believe in strongly that you can create whatever you want in the United States and in this state. And I just, my experience, one of the reasons I got involved in politics is I didn't like what government was doing. That was 12 years ago, and I don't much like it today either.
All right, hold tight. We're going to take a break for the news, and we'll return with John Schroeder. And he's got much to say about the Main Street Recovery Program, which, of course, is vital in these times. 877-217-5757, your number, back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. 877-217-5757, your Talk Louisiana number. You can always send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. John Schroeder is our guest for a few more minutes, the state treasurer for the great state of Louisiana, and he has started accepting applications, his agency has, for Main Street, and this is an important program. And I know you've gotten some heavy activity in the early going. What's going on, and how significant is this program, Mr. Treasurer?
Well, let's start off with the significance. You know, this is $275 million that's set aside that the legislature, in their wisdom, and I mean that in a positive way, recognizes that small businesses are just taking it, taking a hit big time. And the governor supported it and put it in the treasury for me to administer. We've done a great job considering we had 28 days to start and stand up this program. And in the first 3 days, Jim, we probably received just north of 20,000 applications in one process or another. They at least started the process. I think there's probably about 10,000 that have finished the application. We are running into a few issues that I thought was interesting to see. A certain percentage of those applicants aren't current with the Secretary of State. They're not filing the annual report. Another certain percentage haven't filed their taxes. And then a large group aren't. You know, this program, you have to show your invoices and receipts. And we have a large batch that simply aren't very good at their bookkeeping. So we're working through that. I'm actually working closely with several of the business centers at the different schools. Southern and Baton Rouge has been a big help and has had a couple of very good webinars or at their location there in Baton Rouge. So we're working through it. We got a lot of things going on, but we still have a long way to go. I want to strongly encourage the people who I talk a lot to personally one-on-one, just don't believe there's enough money for them to apply. But due to a couple facts, one, the first 21 days is open for businesses that have received no funding. It doesn't make those who have received it ineligible. You just have to wait past the first 21 days. So I encourage all the businesses to apply. We're probably somewhere at the end of the day need 30 to 35,000 applications to give away the $275 million, and we're just around 10 now.
How many do you think will be the threshold?
I think probably around 30,000 based on what we're seeing. A lot of people aren't claiming the full $15,000. A lot of people, we have this quick relief choice, and probably over half have taken that, which means if you haven't received any funding or aid from the federal government, you can elect to send a copy of your taxes in from last year and accept a $5,000 grant. And probably half the applicants have chosen that, which was a little bit of a surprise to us.
You can go to LouisianaMainStreet.com and apply. That's LouisianaMainStreet.com. $275 million in grants to small businesses across the state. The treasurer says about 10,000 businesses have completed applications. I would imagine that many in this day and age are doing so maybe even on their iPhones. How many are using a mobile device? Do you keep track of that sort of thing?
We are. You know, the technology, Jim, you can track everything today. It's and that's been a surprise, too. About 65% of the people coming to the website are doing it through their phones. The problem is you have to, in order to make an application, you have to show documentation. So you have to be able to download documentation with your application to qualify for the grant. That's part of the federal law. So if you have invoices and expenses, if you have expenses, you have to show those expenses by showing proof by invoice or receipt. So that's causing some issues as well, but we're working through it. The Postal Weight in Meadowville right there in Baton Rouge is doing a great job. They're actually going to reach out to all these individuals and to the ones that are struggling. We can see who's online every day, what time. It's sort of amazing. And we can reach out to those that are struggling for any particular reason. The pandemic has certainly put a dent into my ground game, meaning that we knew when we started that people would have a problem with the documentation side of the law. So we were hoping to have a lot of places where people could go, but due to the pandemic, you know, and the liability, that's been an issue. So we're going to bang through it. We're contemplating even letting people mail it in. But we have till November 1st, and we're pretty confident that the money is going to be long gone before November 1st.
Well, it's, again, LouisianaMainStreet.com. Some of the eligibility requirements, you must have been domiciled in Louisiana as of March 1st of this year, suffered an interruption of business, at least 50% owned by one or more Louisiana residents, filed Louisiana taxes in 2018 or 19 or will file in 2020, had no more than 50 full-time employees as of March 1st, 2020, and have customers or employees visit a physical location. One of the other ones that's kind of interesting, this does not exist for the purpose of advancing partisan political activity and does not directly lobby federal or state officials. So the rules are not that complex. LouisianaMainStreet.com, and it is a good program, $275 million available. And Treasurer, I understand, based on what I have heard from your office, that most of the applicants are minorities, women, and veterans. Are you tracking that as well?
Yeah, we're tracking everything except what time you wake up in the morning. we you know, from that aspect, Jim, we were a little worried how we were going to get, you know, there's a $40 million set aside for the first 60 days, and how do we target that $40 million at minority, women, or veteran-owned businesses? Well, to our surprise, although it shouldn't be a surprise, we've worked very hard at outreach, and I've traveled the state. I don't know, we've had somewhere north of 40 different webinars with hundreds and hundreds of people by now. So that's that minority number somewhere in the 70% range. So we've done a good job, and our feedback's been a lot of people thought it was a program for minority-owned businesses. So now we're trying to make people understand, no, it's everybody. Everybody's eligible. Even if you receive some aid, that aid, whatever you receive, will be deducted from the amount of your claim. But look, we are manning phones 6-7 days a week, 8 to 8 Monday through Friday, and 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on weekends. Jim, I think you probably have that phone number.
I do.
888-795-4947. So if people have any questions, feel free to call. You know, I've given my phone number out personally at my office. My Baton Rouge number is 342-0016, and I'm happy to take phone calls from people. You can send me an email. I do it all day long. But this is important for small business, as a many, many businesses may not even open back up, Jim. So even if you've closed in the last month, this might give you a second thought. You know, because your rent's covered, your utilities are covered, your insurances, your payroll. So it could be the difference between somebody permanently closing or opening back up in a few months.
Well, again, if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, the number between 8 and 8 Monday through Friday, 9 to 1 on weekends is 1-888-795-4947, 888-795-4947. The treasurer's number is 225-342-0016. And lastly, disagreement you and the governor had regarding unclaimed property made it all the way to U.S. News and World Report. You have reached a deal. Are you satisfied with the resolution?
Well, I'm satisfied that we eventually agreed to disagree and that the people of Louisiana will get an opportunity to vote on it in November. But I think it's good policy. And you asked earlier about whether we disagree. I have a different philosophy. Would be a process that would raise money for the state of Louisiana, which would not raise taxes. It would be the only trust fund that the money goes into the state general fund and doesn't turn to the taxpayers of Louisiana to raise money. So what it does, Jim, it takes the unclaimed property money and we create a trust fund to where the state could no longer take the balance every year and stick it in a state general fund. We'll save it. We'll put in a trust fund. It allows us to invest it like we do the other $8 to $9 billion in trust funds that help education and a whole host of things. And this money will be targeted for the state general fund. It'll be the only one like it. And all while protecting the money, the principal, and allowing us to run the unclaimed property fund. So at the end of the day, I got what I want. I think it's good for the state. I say it's really the citizens of the Louisiana. So we need to get on that soon. That will be on a ballot on November 3rd. And I think it's an important piece of policy for the state.
The election, by the way, is 13 weeks from today, 91 days. Again, the number for the Main Street program, if you did not hear earlier, 888-795-4947. You can go to LouisianaMainStreet.com. We've only got a few seconds left, but a listener asks, how much unclaimed property is there right now in the state? Treasurer, do you have that?
Yeah, on paper, Jim, it's about $900 million. And before we run, businesses have a lot of money in this program as well. It's not just individuals. Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time and resources during the pandemic and probably found an extra $8-9 million.
This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us. We close the hour with remarkable writer Robert Draper, native of Houston. Guy's been in the game a long time. He is the grandson of Leon Jaworski, who served as special prosecutor during the Watergate scandal, graduate of the University of Texas at Austin, and he has been a prolific writer for the New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, GQ, and he also wrote a previous book, a bestseller, Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. His latest is an expansion on his previous work, To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. And you believe, and of course the case is compelling, that we had a failed decision-making process. How flawed was it, Robert Draper?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jim. It was egregiously and systematically and thoroughly flawed. And I want you to know that, you know, I went into this project really more out of curiosity, kind of as a matter of unfinished business, since, as you mentioned, I had done a previous book on George W. Bush, who I had known back in the 90s when he was governor of Texas and I was a staff writer at Texas Monthly. But as I gathered my reporting for this book, it just became apparent to me that the misjudgments and the dysfunctionality of the decision-making apparatus in the Bush White House led to a historic failure and a true tragedy that would not only cost, you know, something like 44,000 lives or 4,400 lives in terms of American troops, but nearly 100 times that amount of Iraqis. So it bears inspection as, you know, a the single most consequential foreign policy decision of the last 50 years, but also because I think that it gave rise to the presidency of first Barack Obama and then Donald Trump. So it is part of the through line that we, you know, that has us where we are today.
Now, the war started in early 2003, March 20th to be precise, and we have a shortcut with Dick Cheney, the vice president at the time, on this program in 2002, December 3rd. Here's what he was saying about why he believed the United States was on the brink of war.
The objective, Jim, is to strip Saddam Hussein of his weapons of mass destruction, his biological and chemical weapons, and stop his effort to build a nuclear weapon. We know he's doing all of that. We've got intelligence that confirms it. The effort by the United Nations is one they undertook after the president went to the UN last September and, in effect, reminded them that for 11 years they've totally ignored the developing problem in Iraq, passed resolutions and not acted on them. This time around, we wanted to insist on a full accounting from Saddam, that we wanted the inspection regime and the UN Security Council to address this issue and to make certain that he's not harboring these kinds of capabilities. We're concerned about Iraq because of the possibility that he may at some point share this technology with a terrorist organization such as Al-Qaeda. We know he has a relationship with Al-Qaeda that goes back some 10 years. We know he's provided training to the Al-Qaeda organization and chemical and biological capabilities. And we know he has himself used chemical weapons on the Iranians and on his own people. And given all of that, it's vital that he be stripped of that capability. And the question before the House now is whether or not the United Nations is up to the task. Can they get the job done through the inspections regime? Or will we have to use other means? And the president's made it clear that if the UN can't handle it, then he's prepared to lead a coalition that will, in fact, rid Iraq of those weapons of mass destruction.
Robert Draper's book is To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. Was Dick Cheney the ringleader?
He wasn't the ringleader, but what is really important to underscore, Jim, is that in listening to that very interesting clip, roughly 80 to 90% of what the Vice President of the United States said was categorically false, beginning, of course, with the fact that Saddam did not have weapons, did not even have an active weapons program. The intelligence community did not know that they had one. So all of these things he says is certainly are not the case. He said as well that Saddam had meaningful ties to Al-Qaeda, that they had trained Al-Qaeda for how to use weapons. That was information that came from a gentleman named Al-Libi, who was tortured by the Egyptians and later recanted that interrogation. I was actually just on the phone a few minutes ago with a CIA case officer who was involved in the interrogation of Al-Libi, and he was telling me how false that was. It's also the case that Vice President Cheney was framing this as something that likely the Americans would have to do something about because the UN probably wasn't up to the task. You could hear the skepticism in his voice when, in fact, the UN weapons inspectors got ground truth in early 2003 before the war. The ground truth was there wasn't any weapons to find. But if you proceed from the assumption that Saddam has the weapons somewhere, then when Hans Blix and his inspection team comes back with blanks, the only conclusion you can draw is, well, they must be incompetent. So we know the weapons are there. We'll have to go get them ourselves via military force. So it's no, he was not the ringleader, to answer your question, Jim, but it certainly is a very, very powerful member of the administration, was leaning heavily into the case for war. And when Bush ultimately decided, as the ultimate decider, that he had no choice in the matter, it was partly because he was surrounded by people who were insistent that Saddam had weapons and would use them against us and confederate with Al-Qaeda when none of the above was true.
But the vice president said it with such conviction.
Yeah, it's remarkable to hear that, right? I mean, anyone who wasn't privy to the intelligence, the American public, for example, had every reason to trust the Vice President of the United States. And remember, this is, you know, to go back in time, I mean, here we are today, and trust in government is at an all-time low. But after 9/11, actually, Americans began to put a great deal of faith in both the executive and the legislative branch. And so it was a rather novel thing to consider the possibility that the Vice President of the United States might be lying through his teeth, which, frankly, he was. I mean, Cheney knew fully well that the evidence was not dispositive, was not anywhere near 100%, that these were essentially educated guesses. But he had made up his mind, first, that Saddam was a threat, and secondly, that it just did no one any good to be speaking with caveats, that you needed to speak with the kind of declarative sentences we just heard, but that ill-served the American public, who needed to know that the case for war was shaky at best.
Yeah, he said, we know it, we know it. Now, he roped in Colin Powell. How did he do that?
Well, Powell was actually one of the few doubters in the principles of the Bush administration. The Secretary of State thought the case for war was suspect, thought that Saddam probably had weapons, but lots of people have weapons. It didn't mean that he was a threat to America, that it would erode our coalition as we were trying to prosecute the war on terror. But when Bush said to Secretary Powell in January of 2003 that his mind, Bush's, was essentially made up and said, I want you with me. Are you with me? Powell figured, well, what choice do I have in the matter? He's the president. I know how to do a war, and so I'll help. Unfortunately, Powell's role became not to help fashion the war, but to fashion instead a case for war, and gave instead this rather infamous speech before the United Nations Security Council on February the 5th, 2003, in which he laid out what he believed was hard, cold evidence of Saddam's weapons program, when in fact people, as I detail in my book, were watching in real time, who knew better, who knew that the case was almost entirely false. In that sense, Powell was kind of set up. He was the most popular man in the administration. Cheney and Bush both urged him to use that political capital, to use that popularity for the good of selling the war, and Powell did so, I think, to his later regret.
The book is To Start a War, from Robert Draper. David in Atlanta. David, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning. Please be brief.
Sean Hannity said the weapons of mass destruction were smuggled out of Iraq before the war, and I've read articles that's absolutely not true. George W. Bush ordered a review of all the intelligence and found nothing. What's the opinion of your guests?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was no evidence whatsoever that the rumor was that they had been smuggled and were in the deserts of Syria. It stretches credulity to imagine that 17 years later these weapons have not resurfaced. No, instead, the evidence is overwhelming that Saddam had abandoned his weapons program by 1992 or 1993 at the latest. There were simply no weapons to smuggle out.
Is the chain apparent that it went from Bush to Obama to Trump? If we had not gone through this episode of a war without a reason, would we be where we are right now?
Yeah, I think the evidence is overwhelming, again, that that's what occurred, that the man who beat Hillary Clinton in the primary as something of an underdog was Barack Obama, who could say, I was against the war because of his speech as a state senator, when Senator Hillary Clinton, in fact, voted for the war. Then, 8 years after Obama became president, Trump cleared the field against his primary opponents, basically saying, look, all of this expertise, all of these experienced people, what good did it do us? All we got out of this was a logjam in Washington and an endless war. He was able to sell himself, paradoxically, Trump was, as a kind of anti-war candidate who said that it was a foolish decision. Really, it was a kind of apostasy for a Republican to commit back then, but it helped differentiate himself and make himself a more plausible candidate against people like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. So, I do think that Trump is where he is today because of the follies of Iraq.
And Robert Draper writes about it compellingly, To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. Thanks for joining us, and congratulations, Robert.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Back tomorrow with John Berry. Until then, for Matt Doyle, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.